Podcast People's Podcast. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of What Most People Think. And I'm going to get straight into the guest today because we have that wonderful thing, which is a debut on the show. First time appearing is comedian Scott Capurro. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Namaste.
You know, you're a guy, you've done, you did GB News Headliners.
I did for a while, yeah.
You did for a while, you've done Comedy Unleashed. So you're one of these people that's happy to crop up and, you know, what I count at now is the gentle end of that spectrum, old Uncle Jeff. So, but yeah. you're not afraid to sort of whip up a storm from time to time. So I'll talk to you about all of that stuff as we get on through the show. But you did do a voice in Star Wars, The Phantom Menace. So can I just get my nerdy element out of the way?
Oh, yes, I did. Did you want to hear the voice?
Oh, my God. If you're willing to do it, yeah.
They've asked me to record a game. I'm going to go into a studio here for these producers in California this week. I do them every so often because that voice is quite popular, I guess.
So it was from The Phantom Menace. It was the two commentators on the pod race, and you did one of the voices.
I think the voice is something like, and now off we go into the beyond, something like that.
Amazing. And all these years later, still earning money out of it.
Well, they're great. You know, the games are really fun. And I feel totally honored to still be a part of even a small, minuscule part of the franchise. I think you can still buy me in a store. I'm still an action figure.
You're a Star Wars action figure. I would kill to do that.
It's Greg Proops is one head and mine is the other.
And did you ever do like the convention scene and all those guys?
I have done them, yes. I have.
And a lot of virgins there, I'm imagining. I mean, also, you're not going to say insulting things about the Star Wars universe because you're still getting paid by them. So I can.
I do stand-up at some of them. And at the stand-up show at night, once they've had a couple of beers, after all the signings, they're in a great mood and you really make fun of them. They love it. But while they're rolling up to ask you for either a signing or a photo, yeah, of course, you're nice because you're a guest at their event. But the people that really sex it up are the women. They really go. They do the horn tail, sexy sex thing. It's pretty wild.
Oh my God, the outfits. Don't even go there.
Oh, that's brutal. I mean,
I knew that I was straight when I saw Princess Leia in the slave outfit. I'm guessing that's maybe when you knew you weren't.
No, I wanted to wear the outfit. That's how I knew I wasn't.
And we will, of course, be talking politics because last week a lot of the chat was about Labour's first year in office and there was a lot of pundits' takes, right, a lot of political experts' takes, but there was this bit of polling done by More in Common towards the end of the week for the Sunday Times, which actually I think showing where people are at, and I think it'll be interesting to first tell you as the audience what that polling was and then me and Scott will talk it over. I mean, there was some stuff that came out about Starmer that was interesting, I think. I mean, he definitely seemed to suffer more from last week than anybody else in the Labour Party. I'm going to speak to Scott, as it's a useful week to discuss this, Scott, as my gay correspondent, but the Pride March in London, I would have felt it was difficult any other week, two straight lads talking about this, but I'm going to get some expert on-the-ground analysis because the Pride London just happened this weekend, just gone, and they're reporting a reduction in kind of sponsorship and also volunteering. So we might talk about why. I mean, it's still massive, but we might talk about why that might be. And then in the Patreon-only section, we're going to discuss offence in comedy. And why I think, Scott, you've told the most controversial joke that I've ever heard. So we're going to discuss that. So if you want to know what that is, join the Patreon. New patrons. We don't have any new ones this week. We had a bunch last week. But yeah, you get the show early, ad-free, and with bonus content. And this week, you might get to hear at least the theme of what I believe is the most controversial joke I've ever heard, certainly at the Comedy Store. And yeah, you get your breaking news episodes like everybody else, but you get your monthly Q&A episode. And also we do this thing, Scott, called Domain Talking Point, where we've got a patron called David Domain, and I've called it Domain Talking Point. What do you think of that as a format point?
I see what you've done there, and I admire that.
Good.
That's interesting.
We experimented with another format things. We used to have a thing called the cuss count, which older listeners will remember, where we sort of had a league table for who swore the most. Are you a big swearer in your stand-up?
I think I can be. I use the cuss words mostly as adjectives or adverbs. I don't really use them as nouns. In fact, someone I knew when I first started said, Your setups are filthy, but your punchlines are clean, which is the way I've always tried to play it.
That sounds like a coded thing that you'd have on Grindr, the filthy setup, clean punchline.
It does. How do you know that? Okay, well, we'll talk about that later, off camera, or for the Patreons.
But basically, David keeps tabs on things from previous weeks. So there was a couple of things that... And I was talking about punny names, like on the comedy circuit. So you would have been around the circuit a bit longer, but we've both been around a while. So we've seen, do you remember when comedians used to have puns for names? So like, yes. Ian Cognito was one. There must have been others. There was Agraman in Manchester, who was an anagram. Yeah. That was an anagram of anagram. There's one at the moment that I think plays Comedy Unleashed, Frank Sinatra.
Yes, there is.
But it
yes.
manages to look like an Italian name, like Sinatzi. But
it does, yeah, yeah.
Frank's a Nazi. So, yeah, there
and were. He has music puns as a cross between Hitler and Sinatra. He sings music puns as well. The whole act is one long pun, really. It's brilliant.
And there was, I mean, you know, if you think about the producers as well, there is something in Hitler that kind of has a Venn diagram with musical theatre. I don't know why that is.
And comedy. I think it's the extreme. It's so much fun to make parody of something like that, or to try to reproduce it, because it's so ridiculous. To take it farther is even funnier, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose comedy, they always say is the difference between what you want and what you end up with, right? A status drop. And I suppose what Hitler wanted was a 1,000-year Reich.
Right.
And what he ended up with was shooting himself and his dog. So, you know.
But at least he had a dog. But
at
I
least
think,
he had a dream.
Yeah, he did. But I think he's going to live for another 1,000 years on the cable news network, at least. They love him there. They love him
on the
National Geographic channel. They can't get enough of Hitler.
Well, it's like Channel 5 as well. Like, you know, you get – it's free. If you want to make a documentary, right, you make it about Hitler, the royal family, something from Yorkshire – something about Yorkshire. I mean, you could just call it something about Yorkshire.
Yeah, yeah.
And how stuff is made. Have you noticed that with documentaries? Like,
yeah.
Just how something that you consume every day is made.
Yeah, or repaired.
Repair, oh my God. So if we were to go, how do you repair a royal reputation using kind of a material from Hitler's... outfit and a vet. You'd have to get a vet in there somehow. Maybe bring Hitler's dog back to life.
Yeah. How do you reclaim your fascism if you're Irish? Oh, here's how.
how do you repair your ideology? David also says that. So I was talking about that line. Do you know the famous line where, and I was saying, I didn't know if it's Noel Coward or Oscar Wilde, but it's one of those witticisms where he says to a woman about the price that she'd ask for sex, and then she says she'd ask for a lot of money, £1 million, and then he says, right, we've established what you are, now we're just haggling over the price. Basically calling her a slag. I mean, I don't know how one of the great witticisms. But we were trying to work out who said that, and it's been attributed, but you know the line, right? Do you know the line?
I've heard it. Yeah, I think I have heard it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not Oscar Wilde, huh? No.
I thought it was Oscar Wilde. He was always, you know, he was always trotting out lines like that. But George Bernard Shaw, Churchill, but it appears that Lord Beaverbrook is the
guy. That was my second guess, of course. who is that? Is that someone famous?
I don't know. All right, so next week, David Domain, you've got to tell us who the hell Lord Beaverbrook is. I mean, the thing about those witty guys, right, you know, those famous things that they said at dinner parties. I mean, I think the Mary Whitehouse Experience did a joke once. You know that line where she says, oh, I think it's Oscar Wilde. Imagine if it had my beauty and your brains. And he says, but my dear, what if it had your brains and my beauty? And everyone goes, wah, 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 wah. So we remember all the funny ones, but there must have been times when it was like they were trying out stuff and it just didn't really land.
Yeah, you know, it's odd. Sometimes I will return back, I call it home, although it's not anymore, but I'll go back to California and I'll do local radio to promote gigs. And I will have been here for a year and I speak to the local DJs, and the first few sentences I say, they have no idea, they can't understand what I'm saying. Why, they think I'm being mean, but I'm not. I'm being sarcastic, but they don't. They think I'm just being brutal and mean, and they ask me to tone it down to the commercial break. Always.
So there was always that thing, like, Americans don't get irony. I've always thought Americans do get irony, but they don't like sarcasm.
They don't like it. They think it's mean. They think you mean what you're saying. They get that you're trying to make fun, but they take it personally. It's not personal. I don't even know you.
It's a fair point. You know, like one of the great examples of sort of British sarcasm is if somebody attempts something like on stage or in public and it sort of fails and was a high risk strategy, and you say, oh, that was brave. And people might just go, thank you. Thank you for recognizing the creative risk I took there. No. What I mean was that was stupid.
Yeah, that was awful. You suck. Yeah, I know. But I always think that if someone responds verbally to you in the UK without throwing something, that it's as close to a compliment as you're going to get, whatever they say.
Especially if you're in Newcastle during stag and hen season.
There's that. I mean, I've had so many, I'm sure you've had thousands too, of things said to me that were backhanded compliments. I'm sure they meant well by what they were saying. Mm. I've had people cross the room at the Edinburgh Fringe, gay men, to tell me how awful I am. I mean, they think they're helping. So it's just the way it is here. It's just people will tell you exactly what they think. And if you listen, you can really get a kernel of assistance, maybe, if you listen to what they're saying.
In this country, is it the same in the States, but people get angry about bad comedy? I've never understood why people get so angry. More than any other art form, if comedy's bad, people are fucking furious.
I think it's because they can take it out on the person creating it. I think if you're in a play and the play sucks, where's the playwright? Probably dead. Who are they going to blame? They just appreciate you giving your time to this. So buy a glass of wine and tell you how good you were, but how awful the play was. But if you're a comic, they assume what we're saying. Even here, I think people think that it's real, that what we're saying is part of who we are. I think that's become more severe. I think this whole idea around ideology and, you know, identifying ourselves in a very particular way, since we're going to talk about pride in London, I think that's become more part of people's lives. They're staring at their phone all day long and they forget that there's a world outside of what they think.
Yeah, that you can play with language and ideas for effect.
Yes, exactly. And that there's other ways of expressing yourself other than the way this one person does on their phone. I mean, I think young people can now file these hate crimes, nonviolent hate crimes in London against performers, which probably will get worse. But I've had a few filed against me at a couple of comedy clubs in London over the last year for being homophobic and Islamophobic.
I mean, as a gay man, like being accused of being homophobic, how does that feel? It must feel weird.
Well, the police called the club and told them, and the club thought it was a gag. And then the cop said, no, this is a policeman, actually. Is he there? And the club owner said, well, his husband works here. Do you want to speak to his husband? No, can you tell his husband that he's homophobic? We just had a conversation. It was very British, I think. But I think that the woman who filed it against me assumed that I was not, that I was mocking homosexuality. Mm. But part of that is because I'm old. These are things you have to accept when you, I'm telling you. In fact, my gripe, can I tell what my gripe is? Because we haven't.
Do you know what? Hold that back and we'll do the thank you and the fuck you. What most people think. Okay, so we'll get to Scott's gripe very quickly. But the thank you I want to do, just to the Edmonds family, a very family, close family to me, somebody passed away in the family and I was with them. I just wanted to send them a bit of positivity. And also to the Edinburgh Fringe. People are buying tickets for my Edinburgh Fringe run. It's the 14th to the 20th. No, it's the 11th to the 20th. Oh, fucking hell. Fuck this.
Whatever.
It's the 11th. It's when it is. If you Google Jeff Norcott Edinburgh Fringe, if you haven't got the wherewithal to do that, frankly, don't come to the show. But it is the 11th to the 24th of August. And yeah, they're selling quicker than they have for previous runs. So if you want to see me at the Fringe, do get up there. All right. What is your gripe? So this is related to what we were just chatting about a minute ago, Scott.
Oh, right. At this comedy club on Saturday, a young person told me I was a gilf, which I had to look up.
Granddad, I'd like to fuck.
That was hard to hear. It's hard.
Oh, sorry. I didn't say, I would not think of you that way. I was decoding. I wasn't saying, like, oh, yeah, I see.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, of course that makes sense. Yeah. I called you that for years. No, they were very young. They were there. They were actually had shown up to see a very well-known Indian comic who was in town. And so they were a young South Asian audience. I would think in their mid-20s. So to them, yes, I'm grandfather age. But just don't, if you're young, don't tell people that. I know it's funny to you. Tell your friends.
I mean, there is a positive to that, is that they did want to bang you.
Yeah, there's that.
You could be, what is it, a guilt, granddad, I don't want to fuck. What would that be? A G-I-D-W.
Yeah.
Gidwuff.
That's the anagram for the new Jeremy Corbyn political party. But yeah, I think, it was between shows. I had to do another one. It was on my mind the whole time. But, you know, it's what I'm saying is, you know, like when I was got that homophobic thing. I think it was because this young person in the audience, I wasn't reflecting them positively. And I was from a different generation. And they wanted me to know that this is not the way gay people communicate any longer. The gay people don't even call themselves gay any longer. So get over, you know, they're now queer and they're now LGBTIQ plus A. The G is being pushed down the row. We may disappear at the end. We may pop out and never come back. I don't know.
Yeah, go and get your own pride, for God's sake, jumping on all the other people's. But we'll, as I say, we will discuss that later in the show. But we will start with politics in this recent polling, which suggests more clearly where the public are in this government than the pundits. So as you know, Scott, last week was the anniversary. I thought anniversary is such a weird word for such a turbulent year of government. What kind of first year of marriage would that be? Would that be a couple of affairs?
The honeymoon period, really, isn't it? It's a honeymoon
should
period.
Should be, but it felt like they were already sleeping in separate beds.
I felt like there'd been a stabbing. Not a death, just, you know, a fondue fork in the neck.
That's such a 1970s domestic assault, isn't it?
Abigail's party.
So More in Common, who were more accurate with their polling in the build-up to the 2024 election, asked a number of pointed questions on quite a big sample size. And what was interesting, I thought, was they asked about a sense of chaos, because last week the Labour government, they went with their welfare bill. They'd already watered it down once, then they watered it down again. Then they watered it down in real time on the floor of the House, which was a new one. It was literally like they were riffing. It was like improv, Scott. You know, like the old LA, just go, okay, throw me up an idea. Okay, right, this guy over here.
Yes, and.
Let's keep it going. Okay, now throw me up a kind of benefit and a level of reduction.
Dental care, yes, and. Yeah.
And the net effect of that was, by the end of the week, seven in 10 people felt that this Labour government was as chaotic, if not more chaotic, than the Tories. And I sort of wondered, there is a bit of what they call regency bias, of thinking what's going on most recently counts for more than what went before. I just thought, first up, the question I ask you, is that fair? Is it true on a pound-for-pound basis?
You know, I think the problem is, I mean, you know, with Boris, things were chaotic, but Boris had a story. You know, it was levelling up and getting out. And I just think Labour doesn't have anything for people to sink their hooks into. They don't know what Labour is. And Labour keeps fiddling with, well, you saw it last week. They're fiddling with the edges, aren't they? A couple billion here, a couple million there. You know, we'll sink that boat in the English Channel, but not that one. Like, they keep playing with stats. But nobody knows anything more about Keir Starmer than they did a year ago. He seems opaque. And I think even though, you know, the Home Secretary is a complete disaster, people forget she even exists. And the Home Secretary is quite a sturdy character in any cabinet.
Yeah, it should be a high profile because, you know, we had Priti Patel, Suella Braverman. No one's talking really about Yvette Cooper, are they?
Nobody. No, because she's such a disaster on camera and she almost looks like she's about to weep at any moment. They're all teary-eyed. This one crying last week. They all seem to be crying half the time. They're so easily manipulated and moved. We just saw, like, again, we saw that last week. They themselves don't know their story. What is their thing? What's their driving force?
I don't know. I suppose it was kind of like we're going to steady the ship, and they were so desperate not to. They had the polling lead, and they were desperate not to mess it up. But that did mean that as I discussed last week, I did an episode Friday where I was saying that they hadn't really struck a deal with the British public. It's like you change broadband providers, but only because the previous one was so shit.
I think a lot of the public in the UK, from what I've read in the Times and online and other places from staff, is that people think it's broken. And if you can't pretend then, and they know this in the Labour Party, you can't pretend then that whatever needs fixing doesn't need fixing. It's like your pipe's bursting and your plumber saying, no, you're fine. Just stand under that water.
Yeah, but you remember how burst it was before with the last guy? This is less burst.
maybe. Maybe it appears that way. Maybe it isn't for some people. And maybe the numbers don't add up for most people. That's why.
Well, it does seem that, you know, there are these issues of expenditure, and it's either that you sort of say, right, we're going to take a reduction in overall GDP, we're going to hit the wealthy and stuff, but we're going to give some of that money to the least well-off, but accept that the economy might shrink. It feels like there is coming a point where they're going to have to do one thing or the other and be explicit about it.
We were just in Norway last week, and Norway and Scotland share a lot of things in common about the progression of their economy in the last 50 years. And when Norway discovered their oil at around the same time that a large oil reserve discovered up in Scotland in the late 60s, early 70s, and all that natural gas, they reinvested all the money back into the public sector. And they have a huge, what is considered a trust fund for the public. Hmm. It's like $1.4 trillion, I think. And it means that everyone's pensions in this generation and the future generations are all looked after. And they're all already there. Hmm. Now, Scotland had that option and the UK had that option. Instead, the UK privatized their oil in the 70s. And no one in the public then, overall public, has benefited in any way then from that. Not in any direct way, not in any
You talk about the Norwegians, the very diligent, responsible people, also quite boring. You know, some of it comes down to national character. Then they have a sovereign wealth fund. Do they have any good music, Scott, is what I'm asking. We're chaotic. We looked at that money and we went, let's get on it and snort it, inject it.
Basically what my husband said. Yes, it's true. And also, no, I know there are different cultures and all that, but what I'm saying is to some people, I think that would mean that we've got to go way back. We've got to be a bit brutal in how the system here is not just repaired, but replaced with something that works. You know, I mean, the people have a lot of hope in this guy running for New York City mayor and the Democratic Party who won the primary over there. He's a progressive thinker. Some people think I like some of his policies. Some I don't. But what he's saying is we've got to start again, again.
So he's a genuine radical, but he's like a left-wing populist, isn't he? He's openly taxed.
He's also incredibly well-educated and incredibly well-connected. And that helps too, because he speaks well. And I think Starmer really suffers from his on-camera appearance. I think he really suffers from it.
You mentioned about the crying earlier. One interesting thing, you talk about how the public receives Starmer, is that the public blamed him exponentially more for the welfare fiasco than Rachel Reeves. Now, I don't know if that was some sympathy because she was crying, but it really came down hard on him. And also, his net disapproval rating is now minus 43, which is massive. I mean, that's really not popular at all.
She played it brilliantly. I pitied straight men when I saw that. I'm like, they never stand a chance. Anyway, women are so good at this sort of thing. But also, he kept saying, I'm not going to tell you the reason she cried. I won't tell you what the argument was about. I won't tell. So it started to seem like it was a personal fight between the two of them.
Well, so from what I hear in the circles I'm moving is that there is a genuine personal thing that they're not willing to talk to the public about now. So, but what I think from the public's point of view is it's very hard to expect the public to think that the stress she was under at work didn't add to that, right? It may well be that there's this completely legitimate thing. And it did seem, that's the problem, is it might be the truth, but it also seemed a little bit convenient. We just go, this is a personal matter. To talk about, and you go, well, it's completely not also not to do with the fact that you've just had the fucking look. I've got personal problems. I also know that if work was shit, I would be more likely to cry than if I had personal problems and work wasn't shit.
But when you cried on stage, I know you never have. I know you're stone cold. But when you've cried on stage, or imagine crying on stage at Edinburgh at the Fringe this year, how much confidence would that build in your audience? None. It has the negative effect. And I think that brought his numbers down. It doesn't build confidence in the leader to see one of the primary cabinet members crying.
I think it is the real world. And you have to acknowledge that that is how the public, because the public won't be delving into the aftermath of this story of people saying, well, there is genuinely something going on that we might find out in real time. What they'll know, economy fucked, Chancellor crying. That'll be
the... You don't want to see your leaders cry. They're supposed to be stiff and hard and, you know, anyway.
But you know what, Scott, what it did make me think was, at first, I was like everybody else. I was like, oh, this, you know, this is sending out a bad image for the British economy. But then I sort of realised, when I've had tough times in life, I thought maybe there's a bit of jealousy. I thought maybe, because a lot of my anxiety and issues came from trying to not let that shit come out. And I thought, there's the chancellor, it's just coming out. Maybe I was just jealous and angry that she was just having a very human reaction to something in public, whereas I would rather
piss off. If it was Japan, she would have cried on camera and thrown herself in front of a moving train. I swear to God. And we would have been done with her and moved on. You cannot show any sort of weakness like that to people when the economy is tanking. They're going to think, look, she's rich and educated. She'll always have a nice life. Even if she's kicked out of the cabinet tomorrow, she'll go on the lecturing circuit. She'll be minted. She's minted right now. If she's crying, I run the corner shop in Bethel Green. We're failing. What's going to happen to us? What if I cry? No one gives a shit. She should hold back, eat more protein, eat some greens, get outdoors, go for a run, and perk up a little bit. A little bit. They don't need to question time once a week. Once a week, you can't cry. Oh, man. She was saving those tears up. She knew that the public hated her, and they were going to put it all on him because the man is mean. Oh, God.
What most people think.
Just for God, there's just one more thing I want to talk about is Starmer's perception of himself. So in these interviews he was giving on the 1 year anniversary, Nick Robinson put it to him that he you've lost the dressing room, right? He made a football analogy because he knew that would get to Starmer because Starmer loves his football. And Starmer said, I'm going to read this out actually because I think I still can't believe this is a genuine quote. Here we go. Starmer said, "I'm a hard enough bastard to find out who it was that said that so that I could have a discussion with him." First up, you're not fucking Tony Soprano, mate. And secondly, referring to yourself as a hard enough bastard.
Oh, God. So I got to have a conversation over a cup of chamomile. No, break their jaw. You have to break their jaw. People like Trump because of the way he talks. No, look, Trump is a monster. He might rip the Constitution up for all we know. I have no idea. I didn't think he was a fascist before the election. Now I'm kind of leaning into the idea that maybe he might be. But people follow him and are connected and attached to him because he says what he thinks, not what he thinks he should say. Starmer talks like that school teacher nobody liked. Oh, God, it's so uncomfortable.
That phrase that you just said, I think, is a really good one. Says what he thinks rather than what people think he should say. That's the point, is after a year, we don't really know the guy. I mean, I remember anything. This is where Farage tends to do well, because I also think very strong chance he is also a snake oil salesman. But when he talks, I remember the leaders' debates towards the end of the last election, and all of the other six leaders sort of gave their scripted 30 to 60 second long monologues that were all on auto cues. And he just won it in one fell swoop by saying, "Well, all of these lot are reading off auto cue. I'll tell you something, you can't just talk for 60 seconds off the top of your head, then you shouldn't be in government." And I was like, wow, he just made you all of you lot do ridiculous. He alluded to an idea that the minimum we should respect is that leaders should be able to communicate. So,
which is what this guy in New York can do too, who's running for mayor. I've seen him speak a few times on camera. He doesn't use notes at all. It's really appealing.
Starmer at PMQs, quite often, he's using notes so clearly with his finger, reading along with his finger. It looks like he's reading fucking Braille. We're going to do the hype here. So just with my tour, we're now getting on for just 2 months out from the tour, 60 dates. So there's a lot. Go to Live Nation if you want to get tickets. We'll just read out a few that need a hype. Not need a hype. They're selling brilliantly, of course. Tring in whatever county that's in. Bath. I haven't mentioned Bath, but I'm back at the Comedia there, which is a lovely venue. Worthing, I'm down on the south coast in Worthing. Birmingham Town Hall, selling well, but it's one of the bigger venues on the tour, so it'd be good to see you there. Aldershot, one of those ones where you park close to the venue, if you know what I mean, Scott. It's one of those, yeah. It's just got a little slight undertone to it, Aldershot. Yeah. Reading as well, the concert hall in Reading, another big venue. Crawley, that's an 800-seater. Again, luckily, it's away from the town centre. By the way, this is what I always end up doing. I always end up slagging off the places I'm going to play. The train station at Crawley is one of the most depressing-looking places in the country.
Jesus Christ. It gave me AIDS. I got AIDS there. Seriously. Just the tourist style.
Just the aesthetic.
Yeah, seriously.
The brutalist architecture. Redditch as well. You know, it's one of those, I sort of walk briskly from the car park to the venue in Redditch.
What is it about you that you choose these places? That's what one has to
Because that's where my people's at. That's where my people are at. All right, now we've got a very middle class one to end with, Monmouth. Okay, Monmouth, very fancy there, so do come along to any of those. But if you go onto Live Nation, I'm playing enough dates that statistically and geographically, I'll be coming somewhere near you. Scott, we should obviously put people towards your social media and wherever you're popping up there. Is there any other specific stuff people should check out?
No. I'm trying to build a bit of a following on social media. I've been bad about that, so I've I've been encouraged to try harder.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to do it too. What I find is it makes me feel exhausted, sad, and it gives me mental health problems. But every so often, every 6 months, I pick up another 100 new followers, of which maybe 10 might buy tickets. So brilliant.
I haven't had a full bowel movement for like 3 months. It's making me feel so constipated, but I'm doing my best. You know, I guess this is how young people feel, constipated all the time. Maybe that's why they're crabby. I'm out there posting clips, trying to draw people in. But, you know, my clips are like this. I mean, I don't make friends. My sister's told me many times, you should try opening warm. I'm like, I don't know. I just don't know how. Do you ever go see a comedian where they have them in the palm from the beginning because they're so warm? Mm. You're warm. Why? I don't know why people – I don't even know why people do it.
I would say, and obviously we'll pick this up in the Patreon only, you're one of the most uncompromising comedians I've ever seen, but brilliant comic as well. So do go and check out Instagram, watch Scott's clips, give them likes, and share them. Okay, so it's Pride the weekend just gone. It was London Pride. That does say, I think there is, isn't there a bitter, like an IPA called that, London Pride as well, which is kind of ironic. London would be the original Pride in this country, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. But we've had years and years of growth there. We've had the Pride flag, of course, which has attracted more stripes than a US general. And more colours has led to more sponsorship. I remember the I used to have a joke about like the acronym that went to LGBT, and I had a literally, Scott, a fucking joke about that being a sandwich at Marks and Spencer's, like bacon, guacamole, lettuce, and tomato. And that actually happened. That did happen.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it became a sandwich briefly, the Pride sandwich at Marks and Spencer's. But there was this story on the BBC, and the journalist job title did make me laugh. His name's Josh Parry, a very good article, but he's the LGBT and identity reporter for the BBC, because I guess they couldn't say woke correspondent.
They didn't have to, really, did they? Because without saying
well,
it.
No, Josh as well. That seems sort of it's a there's these two gay guys on TikTok that basically decide whether names are gay or not, and it's so basic, but it makes me crack up laugh. I think they would decide that Josh might well be. So less sponsorship this year, less corporate sponsorship. It's the first year in many years that it's gone down, and there's less volunteers. So as our man on the scene, Scott, although I'm not saying for 1 second that you were there, you got any theories as to why that's happened this year?
Well, I think the DEI support is down because of what Trump said a few months ago, and I think companies have realized they don't really need to. So where they weren't committed with their souls, they just kind of walked away from these events. Hmm. They're probably quite expensive for them to sponsor. And I think also they feel like they've won the war. They've got the gays on their side. They don't need to do it anymore. You know, in a way, I think they're right. Well, I think they are right. Not just in a way, I think they are. You know, years ago when the sponsorships began at Gay Pride in San Francisco, I say Gay Pride because I'm old. It's about 25 years ago. A lot of the gays were a bit alarmed when Budweiser and Coors, all of them started showing up, putting up big banners. And we liked it. We liked the attention, but we also realized it was going to commercialize an event which had seemed much more grassroots previously. Mm. And it did commercialize it. They started charging people to get in. Alcohol became much more expensive. More famous names are on the main stage. Everything, the price of everything went up at the cost, really, of excluding certain parts of the community. And I think that's happened in London to a certain extent. But I think the Pride events become extremely middle class. And I think the whole identity politics thing has turned away sponsors. I mean, gay men and gay women knew at the beginning that if we were going to get some sort of equality, whatever that meant at the time, which really what we're looking for was medical coverage in the US because so many people were dying, that we could not tell people that their lives were going to change. We told people when I worked at ACT UP, look, this is not going to affect your mainstream life at all. It's just going to make our lives better. We never brought up their children. You never bring up people's kids ever if you're trying to make a political change, unless it involves improving the lives of children. What's happening now with the ideology among some of the gay community is that we're asking people to change their dialogue, the way they speak, the way they educate their children, everything they do when they're around us. And that has made some sponsorships very uncomfortable. They don't want to be associated with that. A lot of gay men I know don't want to be associated with it either.
Well, interestingly, you know, this reduction, I think what you're saying about corporate sponsorship, DEI, maybe they've made their point, all of that stuff stacks up. With volunteering, that's sort of interesting because that suggests this isn't to do with money. This is about people's willingness to be involved from the community. How do you, I mean, you can't answer for everyone, but in terms of it becoming a broader social justice movement, because obviously you've had the inclusion of trans quite a while ago, then Black Lives Matter, gay sort of became queer. I mean, first up, I mean, I get a sense I know the answer to this. Are you gay or queer? I mean, it feels so weird for me to ask because that sounds like something you'd say in the 80s when you were bullying someone, like, you gay or queer?
Well, queer is a bit of a trigger word for someone my age because it's that word they whispered in Europe right before they gay bashed you.
Well, yeah, but I grew up at that time too, so I am so reluctant to use that word because – yeah, it still feels wrong for me to say it. And it's sort of trying to co-opt lots of different, very disparate communities under a social justice movement rather than what it originally was. Right?
And I don't care what people call themselves or what they do, but I think when you're asking other people to change their minds, when you're coercing them and telling them that if they don't behave the way you do, agree with you, that they're wrong, evil, and fascist, I think you're going to lose a lot of support when that starts happening. Now, I think that the drag queen movement's great, but I think if you start calling, say, for example, the DEI community within the gay community, this sort of queer community, started saying, just for an example, and this happened in your parliament here, that the black drag queen that helped lead the Stonewall riots was trans. Now, that person was not trans. That person was a drag queen. That person was not a person of color trans. That was a black drag queen. And if you called that person while he was still alive a trans, he would have beat the crap out of you. So that's not how he identified himself. That's not how anyone then identified him. And there's no point trying to rewrite history to suit whatever cause you're pushing now.
So you think there's been a degree of co-opting in the same way that using the word queer to bring in bigger communities of people, that's happened with other language as well.
It's homophobic. It's pure homophobia. Gay men have been hurled about, used as weapons before, and now within our own quote-unquote community, we're being used in the same way. And we've been here, and we'll survive. And I think the language will change again when people become a bit more sensible and practical. I think in the meantime, there's danger, I think, of the LGBT community imploding. It's probably like the US in a way. It's too much. It's too big. It's too extreme. It's too far. It's too loud.
So are we going to see a gay Brexit from within
yes.
the wider European Union?
Yes, because some gay people who are my age, I guess, maybe younger, we feel like we've won. We've won. Legally, look, there may be gay bashing going on at certain points. There may be homophobic behavior. You're never going to get rid of that. But legally, in this country, we are equal now. So like any other, like so many political movements, when they've run out of enemies, they become carnivores. They start eating their young. They start eating each other. They start making each other within that old community an enemy. Politically, we don't have them within Western Europe, within the U.S. This is why I get so frustrated about, you know, the Middle East. It's like, say what you will about Israel. I've worked there. That says everything. I've worked there. My husband and I, our marriage is legal there. We feel safe there, right? So I just feel like choose your enemies. And right now, at least in the UK, I don't think we have that many, if any.
What most people think.
I mean, this might be a frivolous point I'm making here, but I was thinking about, like, believe it or not, a bit of a scene queen back in the mid-noughties.
I totally believe that.
Yeah. Totally. Well, I because we used to go out, I used to gig, but then I would still want to go out dancing and stuff. And obviously all the gay clubs started later. So me and my wife, it now sounds like I'm protesting a bit too much. Me and my wife, me and Mitch, we used to go out. But even then there was like lads that were around my age that their coming out stories were still stressful. And, you know, like it was still difficult for them integrated. But I have noticed that coming out is less of an issue. You know, a lot of those clubs aren't open in Vauxhall anymore because
they don't need to be.
So I guess the point is like I think like modern gays aren't as cool, but my favorite gays are 80s gays. I mean, is this just the coolest gays ever? Still up against serious prejudice, then, you know, like HIV come out, definitely are they the goats of gays, 80s gays?
Well, I have to say, you know, HIV really galvanized the community. That's when I was coming out, and it was very exciting living in San Francisco in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, arguably it was very depressing also because a lot of my friends died. A lot of artists I worked with are now dead. But the political movement and the social mores and the way we supported and looked after each other, it felt like there was a war on that we were fighting, and we eventually won. But that's the point. We won. So now enjoy your spoils. Again, there's always going to be people who it's difficult to come out. I mean, from whatever community they're from. It has very little to do with class as well.
But then this is now me maybe trying to put the woke argument forward, and this is slightly ironic I've ended up here. But I guess they say, but, you know, morally having won that, you then have to take that set of ideals and then do the same for other communities. But that's, I don't know, slightly presumptuous that you feel that that's something you have to do personally.
Listen, the LGB community has always been uncomfortable initiating the trans community, or as long as I've been an adult, there's been conversation among especially gay women about admission of the trans community. Because really, in the 90s, when I was helping a very small role, helping organize the gay and lesbian pride parade in San Francisco, the Dykes on Bikes didn't want trans riders. They didn't want them. Dykes were like, look, we're women. That's a guy.
Could just double check. Dykes on Bikes, is that an actual name of a group, or is that?
It is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They would lead. No, Dykes on Bikes.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. No, they lead the Pride Parade. They have for decades. Right?
Gotcha.
Especially after AIDS, when a lot of gay men died and the Dykes were organizing the event. And there, it's a great opening. Everybody loves the Dykes on Bikes. You know, I mean, really, the Pride Parade's for families now anyway. And people love it. The kids love it. Everybody loves it. Who doesn't love a big, robust woman on a motorcycle with a girlfriend hanging off her? It's hot. It's fantastic.
Love it. Great name. It rhymes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We all love it. But and some trans people wanted to get involved with that, and the lesbians were like, "No, we no, they're not. They're not gay women." Now we can have that conversation separately. But what I'm saying is, the gay community has always, as long as I can remember, for the last 50 years, let's say, been woke. I started as a comic in a gay and lesbian vegan cafe. You can imagine the stress and the tension I was under. The woman who ran it was a gay woman. If I joked even remotely about having an unsafe sexual experience, she would start crying in the back of the club, screaming, stop, stop, don't. I mean, it was much worse than that. So I'm aware of the boundaries of live performance in an uptight, woke audience. I know what that is.
It's not the first time it's happened, right?
Fuck it. It's always happened. It's always been an element of being an LGBT performer.
Well, do you know what? Because some of that was stuff I was going to discuss for you in the Patreon-only session, but that was a really fascinating chat. So for everyone else, after this, it'll be the end of the show, but me and Scott, we're going to talk about sort of offence in comedy, Scott's act, and yeah, well, interesting. Yeah. Okay, I would say that was pretty much my favourite Patreon-only chat. Really interesting talk about comedy and why Scott remains, for me, one of the most boundary-pushing and genuinely controversial comics I've ever worked with. So do keep an eye, based on what we just spoke about, on Scott's social media channels, because there's going to be interesting things happening there soon. So, Scott, I'd love you to come back on the show. If you're
still alive.
Yeah, if you haven't been assassinated.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one will go down. I'm expecting this to do good numbers, you know, in about sort of 6 months' time. But listen, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. And to everybody else, there will be a breaking news episode later in the week.